The Guard. Chapter 1. On Lorien, I lived in my grandfather's house on the outskirts of the city, the dormitory of the Defense Academy, a basement apartment across from Ilone Park, even a kibarak on the outer territories for a few years after my brother died, when I was happy to be lost and disconnected from Capital City and everything it stood for. None of those places exists now that the Mogadorians have destroyed my planet. Now, I have only Earth, a world where I am not just a stranger, but one of the last of my people. I've been on this planet almost 2 years, but I'm not sure it will ever feel like home. It almost did in a rented cabin in upstate New York for a brief period of time a few months ago. Thanks to the Moogs, that home no longer exists either. It seems like all of my homes are eventually destroyed. Death tends to follow me wherever I go, taking those I care about most. And so I've made it a priority to stay alone, away from others. That's how I end up buying a secluded piece of land I've never set foot on in Alabama. It's dusk when I first see the property with my own eyes, parking in front of the huge wrought iron gate that opens up to a tree-lined drive. The name Yellowhammer Ranch is spelled out in rusty letters, arching over the top. The gate looks imposing, but it's mostly ornamental. As a security measure, it's laughable. There's not even a lock on it. The fencing on either side is just as bad, consisting of a few strands of barbed wire, a barrier that will keep out nothing but stray animals. I wonder if the former owners actually felt safer because of these crude strings of metal. Possibly, I suppose. But then, they probably never imagined that their enemies would come from the sky instead of the winding dirt road that leads to the ranch. I know better. Still, the gate and fence aren't completely useless. They'll both come in handy when I install perimeter security cameras. Maybe a few remote-operated weapons, too, just in case any Mogadorians manage to find me here. With a little push, the wrought iron gate moves, squeaking on old hinges. I get back inside my SUV and drive over the cattle guard. The actual house is located a short drive past the gate and is mostly obscured by rolling hills and trees. It's all thick beams of wood on the outside. I ignore the carport off to the side and drive onto the grass, straight up to the porch. The lawn is yellowed and rises just above the ankles of my black boots when I step into it. I circle the house once, taking in the area, keeping my eyes peeled for anything that seems out of the ordinary or that might pose especially glaring security problems. There's nothing around for as far as I can see in any direction, other than more barbed wire and empty fields and an old barn out back. I'm alone here. No one to disturb my work. No attachments other than to my mission. At least if this place goes up in flames too, no one will be hurt but me. I step over a broken stair at the bottom of the front porch and walk to the wooden door, where there's a big envelope hung up by a thick strip of clear tape. I pull it down and slide out a small stack of paperwork that proves I'm now the owner of Yellowhammer. None of the documents actually has my name on it. I haven't given anyone my real name, Lexa, since I discovered that Mogadorians were on Earth hunting down the Lorik. Not that it would mean anything to a Moog if he heard it anyway. I'm not Pittacus or any one of the other elders, but I am careful. Yellowhammer Ranch is technically now owned by a shell corporation I set up, a subsidiary of another organization of my inventing. All of the paperwork looping together in a way that could never be traced back to me. Lately, I've started to collect identities. I've been dozens of people in the past weeks, sometimes in real life and sometimes in the virtual world. I was Julie when I bought the big black SUV in Pennsylvania. I borrowed a man named Phil's IP address when I attempted to hack into the CIA's intranet. I think it was Lindsay who purchased all the firearms in Kentucky, and Patty who bought all the computer equipment in Tennessee. I take the names from waitresses, magazine covers, and overheard conversations, changing aliases daily, sometimes hourly. Organizing information and data has always been a strong suit of mine, and I bounce between these identities without faltering, storing Julie and Lindsay and Patty away in the back of my head when I'm done with them, in case I ever need to use them again. The people I buy things from at pawn shops and computer stores never suspect I'm not who I say I am, or if they do, they don't say anything. It's amazing how few questions get asked when you're willing to overpay in cash. And thanks to the fairly primitive internet firewalls and security systems used by banks on this planet, money's easy to come by if you're someone who's good with ones and zeros and moving them around like I am. In the past few weeks, I've skimmed minuscule amounts of currency from millions of bank accounts across the world. Money is one of the few things I have a lot of. Money and questions and anger. I tip the envelope farther and a set of keys falls into my open palm. The ranch was trickier to come by. I knew I wanted somewhere far away from crowded areas, or even the nearest town if possible. Remote places like that were easy to locate, but it took me a while before I found someone willing to part with their property in a hurry, and without ever even meeting me face to face. All I needed was to wire some money and forge a few signatures, and suddenly, I owned a piece of this planet. I take another look around the porch, and I can't help but think of how much Zophie would have liked this place. She spent many nights at the old cabin in New York, out on the veranda with a cup of tea, staring at nothing in particular. Probably thinking of her brother Janus, back when there was still hope that he was alive. A shallow ache rises in my chest. It's a feeling I'm familiar with. The hurt that comes when thoughts of Zophie or Janus or my brother Zane settle in my mind. No matter how hard I try to numb myself and keep my memories of them buried, they always manage to find me again. I remind myself that it's not sadness I should be feeling, but anger. That, at least, I can use. It's what fueled me on Lorien when I wanted nothing more than to take down the elders and uproot our society. Now, rage against the Mogadorians is what keeps me going half the time. A burning desire for vengeance in the name of everyone I've lost. But to make the Moog suffer, I have to get to work. And so I swallow hard, shake my head a few times, and unlock the front door. Inside the house is dusty, all the furniture covered with white drop cloths. The skull of a big horned animal hangs over the fireplace mantel. Why the people of Earth choose to decorate their dwellings with the corpses of animals, I have no idea. Killing for sport was an unthinkable crime on Lorien, but based on a few appalling stories I've overheard at hunting supply stores in my travels here, I gather it's not exactly uncommon on Earth. I can only imagine what Creighton's reaction would be if he were here with me, knowing his fondness for chimerae. There's a pang in my chest as I wonder where he is now. Are he and Ella safe? How big has she grown in all this time since I last saw her? Again, I push these thoughts out of my head and keep going. I pull one of the white cloths off a table and toss it over the skull, obscuring it. Then I explore the other rooms. The refrigerator in the kitchen has a huge freezer, meaning my grocery trips to the town's half an hour away can be infrequent. The hall closet can serve as my miniature armory, where I can stash a few of the weapons I've picked up lately. I leave the furniture in the spare bedrooms covered and scope out the office located at the end of one hallway running through the house. This will be where I spend most of my time, the sanctuary in my new base of operations. I start to unload my SUV. Until recently, I traveled light, mostly because Moogs had destroyed almost everything I had on this planet while I was chasing a lead on the guard. For a few weeks, I traveled aimlessly, making my way across the United States, an outsider in a world not my own. I thought about searching for the rest of my people, the guard and sepans from the other ship, According to Janus, they'd scattered. That's what he'd said shortly before the Mogadorians executed him on camera and sent me the video. The evidence I've discovered online seems to back this up. I found hints of them here and there. Pictures of an old man and a young boy with a lauric chest trying to find passage to another continent. Reports of tattooed men chasing a kid in Canada. I'm not sure why they've split up, but for the most part, they're covering their tracks well, staying off the grid. I guess their sepans are competent for the most part. Being impossible to find bodes well for their survival, but not for me finding them. There's some bigger game at play here, but I can't figure it out. Why are the Moogs after these kids? What's so special about them? Why spend resources trying to destroy the last of the Lorik? These are the questions I've been trying to answer, all the while doing my best to help the guard stay out of sight. If I see something on the internet that sounds like it could be related to them, I try to wipe it away or bury it in broken code. But staying on the move has made this difficult to do. That's why I'm here now, at Yellowhammer. It's a base of operations for a coming war. Because if the Moogs are here on Earth, it's probably only a matter of time before they do to this planet what they did to my home. Most of the boxes I have are full of computer equipment I've purchased on my trek across this country. Once everything is piled up in the back office, I begin to piece things together, breaking down machines and wiring them in more efficient ways, building a system that will incorporate the highly upgraded laptop I created in Egypt using Lorik data pads. The custom laptop is fine, but the machine I'm building will allot me more processing power and storage space. The work is tedious, but I remain focused. Night falls, and then the sun rises. I pause only a few times for water and to stretch my legs. When my head starts to pound from concentrating for so long, I take a break and walk around outside, taking note of all the places where I can add some cameras and heighten security once the computer is up and running, something a little more substantial than barbed wire. This place will take a lot of work, but by the time I'm through, it will be a fortress of knowledge and power. I plan to collect every scrap of information I can about the Moogs, those bastards who destroyed my planet, who murdered my friend, will pay. I'll figure out what they're up to and help the other Lorik bring them down. Somehow. Some way. I pull open the half-rusted doors of the big barn out back. They squeal as if they haven't been moved in a long time. Light filters through a missing section of roof, illuminating a few bales of hay and a scattering of tools hanging on one wall. The place isn't much. In fact, it looks as though one good shove could send it clattering to the ground. But it'll do. With any luck, soon I'll have a ship in here. The one that brought the Chosen Guard and their sepans to this planet. Maybe the last Lorik ship in the universe, for all I know. Because whatever it is that the Guard are here to do, they'll need all the help they can get. They're being hunted. We're being hunted. And when they're masters of their legacies and decide it's time to strike against the Mogadorians, they'll need the ship. Hell, I'll fly them to the Moogs myself. Chapter 2. Once my desktop supercomputer, or at least what passes for one on this planet, is set up in the office, I get straight to work. I start with the information I have from Zophie and Janus. It's not much, but that's what I'm here to fix. Since tracking the guard has proven to be nearly impossible, I take a different approach. A lifetime ago, when we were still drifting through space in a refurbished ship, Zophie mentioned that Pittacus Lore had set up a contact for the Chosen Guard here on Earth. If I can find that person, I may be able to get a better sense of what's going on. He or she might even know where Janus's ship is. And there's always the possibility that maybe Pittacus survived the fall of Lorien. Who knows where the elders were when our planet was destroyed? Maybe he's even here on Earth. His contact might know. So I focus my investigation on a simple question. How would Pittacus Lore go about recruiting a human to help the Lorik? I spend countless hours thinking about this, trying to get inside the head of an elder. Would he have sought out a great thinker? Or a military leader? Or perhaps he would have chosen someone with extreme wealth who would have the resources to protect the last of our kind. These inquiries only lead to more questions, though. What Earth languages did Pittacus speak? How many contacts might he have had on this planet? In my time at the Lorien Defense Academy, I worked on improving technologies for Earth, but never thought to ask how those technologies were given to the beings here. For the first time in my life, I regret not sticking it out at the LDA after my brother's death. If I had, maybe I'd have more information to work with now. I barely sleep and rarely leave the back office. With blackout curtains on the windows, I hardly even notice whether it's light or dark outside. Eventually, I realize I may be looking at this the wrong way. Maybe Pittacus didn't find a contact on Earth. Maybe someone on Earth found him. This is something I can use, something narrower. I start looking into Earth's initiatives to contact other planets. There are relatively few. And I'm struck, not for the first time, by how strange it must be to think your small world of dirt and grass and water might be unique in its ability to support life. Over the course of a few days, I follow leads that go nowhere. I break into email accounts and track the browsing histories of a dozen astrophysicists, cosmologists, astronauts, even a few crackpot conspiracy theorists. I uncover nothing that alludes to Lorien or Pittacus lore. Finally, I stumble across a promising candidate. I find information about a man named Malcolm Good, who was outspoken in his belief of extraterrestrial beings. So much so that it apparently cost him his job at a place of education that sounds not unlike the LDA. More important, he published several articles detailing his attempts to broadcast messages to other planets. His research and methods, while primitive, are sound. Once I have a name and a little bit of history, it's not long before I find Malcolm Good himself. He appears to be living in a small town in a state named Ohio. I do more digging and find a few email addresses linked to his name. From there, it's hardly any work to hack into his accounts, where I sift through the everyday correspondences of what seems to be a very uneventful life. Except for one email I discover that leads me to a private online forum. It has been inactive for years, and the correspondences all seem innocuous. Still, I dig around until I find a deleted post still lurking in the lines of code that make up the message board. Hello? Malcolm? Is anyone still on here? Has there been any more contact from the Pittacus? Ethan. I consider trying to contact Malcolm online or over the phone, but I figure that if he is the person Pittacus talked to, he's probably been sworn to secrecy. I don't want to risk having him disappear on me, so instead, I load some gear and weapons back into my SUV and drive from Alabama to Ohio for most of the next day. I hate leaving Yellowhammer unfortified, but tracking down this lead takes priority. Besides, I can't imagine I've done anything there to set off alarms for the Mogadorians. Not yet, at least. Malcolm lives on the outskirts of a town called Paradise. When I arrive, I park down the street and watch his house for a while, trying to get an idea of who this man is. Through my binoculars, I see him pass by the windows, along with a woman and young boy, about 6 or 7 years old, if I had to guess. His wife and son, I assume. I remember mention of them in some of his emails. I watch him water some flowers in the front yard, then wash and dry dishes in the kitchen. His existence seems perfectly ordinary. So normal that I'm concerned I've got the wrong guy entirely. When his wife leaves and the boy runs out into the backyard to play, I make my move. I pull in behind a truck in Malcolm's driveway and park. A few seconds later, I'm standing on his porch, knocking on the door. I keep one of Raylan's blasters tucked into the pocket of my long black coat. I've taken to carrying it with me wherever I go, just in case. Malcolm Good answers the door with a smile. His hair is a little unkempt, dark and wavy. His eyes are bright, brows raised in anticipation.
"Can I help you?"
he asks, pushing thick glasses up his nose. He's on the scrawny side, and I'm much taller than he is. Good. If this goes badly and he ends up less than pleased that I showed up on his doorstep, I'll have that advantage on him. I get straight to the point. "I'm here about Pittacus Lore." He pauses before responding.
"I think you have the wrong house."
"We both know that's not true," I say, but not in English. I use the language of Lorien. It feels so strange on my tongue at first. I haven't spoken the words of my people in months. Malcolm twitches as I speak. His eyes go wide for an instant, and then he blinks a lot, staring at me in a mixture of confusion and astonishment. This is exactly the type of reaction I'm looking for.
"What language is that?"
Malcolm asks quietly, unconvincingly.
"I've never heard it before."
I switch back to English. "I know who you are, Malcolm Good." He starts to shut the door, but my foot is in the way before he can get it closed.
"Listen," I say firmly. "I have no intention of hurting you. I'm only looking for information."
"I don't know what you're talking about," he says, trying to kick my foot out of the way. I put my hand on the door, flexing my fingers and pushing back a little. Malcolm must feel the resistance because his nostrils flare.
"I just want answers," I say.
"I don't know anything." His voice is higher now, verging on panic.
"If you don't leave now, I'll call the police."
"And tell them what?" I ask. "That I came asking about a Lorik elder?"
"You don't want something like that getting into the papers. It'd lead the Moogs right to you."
Malcolm's face goes white. He stops pushing so hard against the door.
"They're here," I continue.
"The Mogadorians. He told you about them, right? Pittacus must have known what was going to happen to Lorien if he set up things with you in advance. The Moogs are on this planet. They've come to Earth. I just want answers."
Malcolm looks up at me.
He searches my face. I can see him doing calculations in his head, trying to figure out what to do next.
"How do I know you're not a Mogadorian?" he asks.
"Malcolm, if you'd ever seen one of those bastards, you'd realize that's the most insulting question I've ever been asked."
He nods a little. "From what I've heard, I can imagine."
"I know about the ones who come from Lorien, the Nine Guard and their mentors. I'm a friend. If I wasn't, I'd have shown up with an army." After a few moments, he takes the rest of his weight off the door, opening it just wide enough for me to pass through. While he pokes his head out the front doorway and looks around, I investigate the first few rooms in his house, taking in my surroundings, preparing for anything. Just because this man was chosen by one of the Lorik elders doesn't mean he's to be trusted. Not by me, at least. Not when I barely have any faith in the elders themselves. I keep one hand in my coat pocket, ready to draw my weapon at the first sign that Malcolm isn't going to cooperate. But he does. He ushers me into his office. Dark wooden shelves line the walls. They're filled with books, files, and papers all piled on top of each other haphazardly. The stacks spill out into virtually every surface of the room, and for a moment, I'm reminded of my small basement apartment in Lorien, packed with all sorts of computer equipment and various electronic projects. Malcolm peeks through the window and looks into the backyard, where his son runs around with some big spaceship or airplane held over his head. When he seems satisfied that the boy is safe, he
He closes the blinds and turns to me.
How did you...
He starts. An old message board, I say.
But we abandoned that well before the ship landed, and we only ever spoke in code. Anything conspicuous was deleted.
Nothing is ever really deleted from the internet, Malcolm. One day your people will figure that out. If it's any consolation, it took me quite some time to find it. He shakes his head.
But we were so careful. There were never any actual details mentioned. That was all reserved for face-to-face meetings.
Someone didn't follow the rules, I say. He considers this for a moment. Then his face twists into a scowl.
I thought I'd gotten rid of...
He sighs.
Nothing is ever really deleted.
He purses his lips a little.
Ethan, I always figured he'd end up being trouble. That's why we cut him out before the ship ever landed.
How did Pittacus recruit you? I ask. Through your messages sent into space? He looks at me quizzically before nodding. I've done my research on you, I explain. Are you still in contact? Could you get a message out to him? Malcolm's eyebrows furrow together, and his gaze falls to the floor.
I'm sorry, he says, but Pittacus is dead.
These words land in my ears, but I feel them in my core, my stomach twisting so hard that I almost double over. This had always been a possible, if not likely, scenario. Still, hearing this for sure takes a little bit of air from my lungs. I always wanted the elders out of power, but never dead. Not really.
We are fewer and fewer.
You're sure? I ask.
Quite positive, he says.
He glances to the window overlooking the backyard and then back to me.
What about a man named Loridas? I ask. Another of the elders, yes? From what Pittacus told me, I think they're all gone as well.
I nod slowly.
Was there anyone else on the ship other than the 9 children and their guardians?
No.
Well, there was a pilot too, but he took the ship to hide it. I'm not...
Janus, I say. His name was Janus.
He's dead too.
I turn away from him, taking a few steps toward a wall of bookshelves as I let all this information sink in.
Who are you?
He asks.
You speak their language. Are you from Lorien as well?
I'm about to answer when I see it, tucked under a few pages of loose paper on a bookshelf. A white tablet. I recognize it. It's Lorik. A tracking device used to keep tabs on ships, inventory, and sometimes even people, depending on how it's programmed. If it's here... In a few quick strides, I'm across the room and the tablet is in my hands, the papers on top of it tumbling to the floor.
He gave you this? I ask. Pittacus did, yes, Malcolm says, though I'm afraid he didn't give me any instructions other than to keep it safe. He was wounded and... Do you know what it is?
I pull my laptop out of my bag and find a connector cable from one of the old Lorik data pads. It slides into a port at the bottom of the white tablet, connecting it to my computer. Within seconds, I've got a map of Earth pulled up on the device.
How did you...
He trails off. I'm good with computers, I murmur. And I use these once or twice back on Lorien. There are blue blips pulsing across the planet. Blue blips that represent people. 10 in all. Could this be the 9 guard plus one more? Maybe Ella? Given her parents' powers, I wouldn't be surprised if she developed gifts early on. Or is there another that I'm not accounting for? And there are 2 triangles too. One triangle is in Egypt. My crashed rocket. The second lies in the southwestern United States. The other ship. My pulse quickens until I can feel it throbbing at my temples. Do you know this area? I ask. Malcolm leans over my shoulder. Let's see, that looks like it would be... Oh. He snorts a little. Yes, I believe that's where the Dulcie base is supposed to be located. A secret government operation. Most people are more familiar with Area 51, but this is no tourist trap like Roswell. Dulcie, I say to myself. That makes sense. If the American government stumbled across Janus's ship, they'd likely want to keep it hidden. At least that means it's not in Moog hands. What's in Dulcie? Malcolm asks. This is perfect, I say, ignoring him. I'll get the ship back. With this tablet, I could easily collect the guard, too. You can't, Malcolm says, shaking his head rapidly. They have to stay separated. They won't stand a chance against the Moogs if they're found alone, I say. Something flashes on Malcolm's face. He shakes his head a little. You don't know about the protection that's been placed on them, do you? He asks. I narrow my eyes. I think we need to have a very long talk, Malcolm Good. Chapter 3. I knew the elders must have been up to something when they'd sent Gar to this planet. I'd even assumed that they'd in some way endangered the young Lorik in the name of the greater good, the sort of thing I expected from Lorien's rulers. Never did I imagine that they would have given these 9 children the order in which they would die and call it protection. In terms of survival, maybe it makes sense. But all I can do is think of the poor unlucky kid who was picked to be number 1. What kind of burden is that to carry around with you? These 9 guard, somehow, they're to be the saviors of our people. That helps explain why the Mogadorians have come to Earth. If the escaped guard will one day bring Lorien back to power, it's not a stretch to assume that they might do so by somehow toppling those who destroyed our planet to begin with. Of course the Moogs want to eradicate them. It's obvious now why they separated. The reason they've scattered so far, these tiny blips on my screen located across this planet. I'd been wary of reuniting them, but now I see for certain that this would be dangerous for everyone. The Moogs could take them out in a single attack that way, destroying all the children at once. Better that they stay separate, at least for now. At least until they're older and stronger, with legacies to fight with. I hope their Saipans are skilled, that they've been given the strongest, most capable mentors from our planet. I have to let them be, as much as I hate to do it. I have to rely on the wisdom of the elders and the capabilities of the Saipans. Even seeking the guard out individually would mean I was running the risk of leading the Moogs right to them, no matter how careful I was. That leaves me with one clear goal. I'm going to Dulcie to get that ship. I'm taking this with me, I say, staring down at the white tablet. What? Malcolm asks. No, why? You can't. You don't have a choice, I say. The tablet is Lorik. It belongs with me. Pittacus told me to protect it. He said it would prove to be useful. Exactly. I'm going to use it. No. Malcolm curls his fingers into fists and plants his feet in front of me. It's my responsibility. I put everything on the line to help your people. My life, my family. Pittacus told me to keep this tablet safe for the guard, and that's what I'm going to do. One of the Saipan, I believe his Lorik name is Brandon, said he'd be back for it if there was trouble. Or when his charge was at the age when he would start developing powers, or whatever you know them as. My hand moves toward my weapon. I don't want to threaten Malcolm with violence. He's right when he says he sacrificed much to help my people after all. But I'm not leaving this piece of technology in the hands of someone who doesn't even know how to use it properly. There's a clattering from the hallway. I turn and see Malcolm's kid standing there. A plastic robot is on the floor in front of him. He's wearing a shirt with an image of Saturn on it, the sixth planet from this solar system's sun. I recognize its rings. I've seen them up close on my journey to this world. The boy is pale and thin and has sandy blonde hair. And even though physically he looks nothing like Zane, there's something in his expression, full of wonder, that immediately makes me think of my brother. It hurts a place inside me I thought had finally begun to heal. "Sam," Malcolm says, letting his posture slacken, "go outside, would you?" Sam just stares up at me. Malcolm looks back and forth between us a few times before crossing the room and pushing Sam out of my sight. I think about the fact that this family in a small town in Ohio has perhaps saved the last of my people, and about how I was considering taking out my blaster and forcing Malcolm to let me have the tablet. What would Zophie say? What would Zane say? I'm not some Mogadorian thug. I'm not going to threaten this man and his son. That's not who I am. Besides, if the Sapons are counting on the white tablet being in paradise, I can't very well take it back to Alabama. "Your son can stay," I say, setting the tracking device down on Malcolm's desk and packing up my gear. "I should be on my way." Malcolm looks confused, but nods. "Tell whoever comes for the tablet that the ship in Egypt is wrecked," I say, moving past Malcolm and his son towards the front door. "Wait," he says. "Who are you? How did you get here? You haven't even told me your name. Where are you going?"
"New Mexico."
I stop on the porch, turning to him.
"Malcolm, take my visit as a warning. I found you. It took me a while, but I did. And that means the Mog—"
I glance at Sam, hiding behind his father's legs.
"That others might be able to as well. Others who aren't as friendly as I am."
Malcolm stares hard at me, nodding a little bit.
"Keep your family safe," I say, stepping down onto the goods yard.
"And the tablet, too. At least hide the damned thing. The last thing we need is for that to fall into the enemy's hands." Malcolm is still on the porch when I back out of his driveway. Sam lingers in the doorframe. As I start down the road, he waves to me. The drive from Paradise to Dulce is a long one. Lush green fields eventually give way to flat plains that seem to stretch on past the horizon. I rest at a motel in Kansas for a few hours, hardly sleeping because for the first time since I arrived on Earth, I know exactly where Janus's ship is, and because I'm worried about how I'm going to get it. I run through what history I can find on this secret base online. Most of it seems to come from conspiracy theorists and quacks, though considering that Malcolm was viewed as one of those by the rest of his profession, perhaps I shouldn't be so quick to pass judgment. It seems that most believe this base is some sort of research facility, which I hope means it won't be guarded too heavily. Maybe I'll even be able to tap into its communications once I'm close by so I can get a feel for what the security is like inside, something I dare not try to do on the motel's unsecure network. Perhaps. Maybe. The uncertainties are many, and I have to remind myself that this is something I cannot rush. I can't just cut through a fence or hop over a gate and storm the base, rushing headfirst into this situation. Only a fool would be so brazen or naive to do so. I get a sense of the area where the base is supposed to be via online maps and photographs, and then try to sleep. The next morning I rise before the sun and drive through the mountains of Colorado, which eventually give way to the arid terrain of New Mexico. Once I spot a chain-link fence topped in razor wire and covered in signs warning against photography and trespassing, I figure I'm in the right place. The base's perimeter is barely visible from the trail-like road I'm on.
It's the middle of the afternoon, and I'm not exactly inconspicuous driving around the desert area in my big black SUV, so I don't test my luck by getting any closer to the fence. Instead, I head to the nearby town of Dulce and pay for a week at a cheap motel. I stash most of my things in a shoddy little room in case I manage to get the ship and have to leave my car behind. I keep a few weapons with me, then round up some additional supplies from a sporting goods store. Night vision goggles, some wire cutters, just in case. At night, I return. I park a half mile from the fence and scope out the site with my new goggles. I don't notice any cameras or alarms. It's not until I get closer that I can finally see the tops of buildings and some of the grounds of the base. I stand a few feet from the fence and observe. And I see things I can't even begin to comprehend. The base is owned by United States government agencies. That's obvious from the information I found online and the signs dotting the fence line warning I've approached a military encampment. I can also see plenty of vehicles with government plates and markings. There are a handful of armed personnel around, wearing camouflage, pacing back and forth. But that's not what causes my mouth to drop open and my hands to shake. There's a ship sitting beside a tall watchtower. Not a Lorik ship, but one I recognize all the same. Hundreds just like it swarmed the skies during the invasion of Lorien, raining fire and death down upon my planet, dropping off battalions of soldiers who slaughtered my people. It's Mogadorian. Holy shit, I whisper. What are the Mogs doing here? My mind reels with the implications. Either the Mogs have taken over this base and are somehow forcing humans to work for them, or... I swallow down a mixture of anger and disbelief. Or the Mogs and the American government are somehow working together. This just got much more complicated. I slowly lower the night vision goggles, trying to make sense of what I'm seeing. It's only then that I hear the footsteps behind me. Chapter 4.
Hands in the air!
A man shouts. Flashlights go on. I hear a few metal clicks behind me. One glance over my shoulder tells me these aren't Mogs. Four men in brown law enforcement uniforms form a half circle behind me, pinning me up against the fence. Their guns are aimed at my back, but the weapons shake a little. They seem almost scared. I take a moment before moving, going over my options. I've got a shotgun in the back seat and Ryland's blaster in my coat pocket. I could try to make a run for it. But these are humans. They're probably just doing their jobs. What are the chances I could make it out of here without accidentally killing one of them? Part of me says I shouldn't care, that me escaping would be for the sake of the remaining Lorik. But that sounds an awful lot like something the elders would say. And I am not an elder. I'm reminded for the second time in the last 24 hours why I like to work behind the scenes.
I said hands in the air where I can see 'em,
the same voice shouts. I turn slowly, raising my hands. The officers look startled at first, but I'm not sure what aspect of my appearance they're surprised by. Maybe the fact that I'm not a man. I've come to learn that just like on Lorien, the people of Earth aren't used to a woman being so tall. After the flash of surprise, though, there's a wave of relief that rushes over them. The one with the big hat on, the one who I assume is in charge, gets in close, putting his flashlight up to my face. He looks at my recently shaved head, then into my eyes for a few moments.
What are you doing here?
He asks. Sightseeing, I reply. He lets out a grunt, but I can see his posture soften. The others lower their guns a little.
This is government property, he says. Trespassing isn't taken lightly.
I'm on this side of the fence, I say. He grins.
Which puts you under my jurisdiction. Now, I know just about everybody in Rio Arriba County, and I've definitely never seen you before, which means we need to get acquainted. Why don't you start by telling me why you're sneaking around in the dark with those hunting goggles?
He motions to one of his men. The officer moves behind me and is patting me down before I can object. He pulls a blaster out of my coat pocket.
What the?
He whispers, wrapping his fingers around its hilt. He's obviously never held a blaster before and doesn't realize what a sensitive trigger it has, because the weapon fires with an electronic sound and melts a hole in my front driver's side tire. The SUV leans as the tire deflates.
Damn it, I mutter.
Suddenly, everyone's guns are on me again, and the man in the big hat's got my hands behind my back. I think about resisting, but there's no way I can outrun them now. One of the men starts asking me questions about some deputy I've never heard of, but the leader shuts him up.
No one talks to her until we're back at the station. This is my interrogation.
Do you want us to keep patrolling the perimeter? One of the officers asks.
Lights off.
The man in the hat nods.
Stay quiet. I don't want anyone seeing you on either side of the fence.
He turns to me.
You have the right to remain silent.
My mind races as I try to remember everything I've learned in passing about the American justice system. Any tidbit of knowledge that might be helpful.
What crime am I being charged with?
I ask as he pushes me towards a car I can barely see in the darkness.
I haven't done anything wrong. Possession of an illegal firearm, the man says, and suspected murder of a police officer.
I piece together what I can from the back of the squad car based on the conversation between the man in the hat, the county sheriff, and one of his deputies. Apparently, two officers went investigating reports of bizarre lights near the base, which I gather isn't that strange a call for this area. But something went bad. Only one officer returned, his body shot full of cauterized holes from some sort of unidentified weapon. Before he slipped into a coma, he said something about men with tattoos on their heads and black eyes. No wonder they reacted so strangely to the blaster firing. Panic starts to settle in my chest once the shock of being arrested wears off. I have no identification. I'm not even human, and I'm handcuffed in the back of a locked-down police car with a thick layer of metal grating separating me from the front seat. I have to escape this somehow. As we shoot through Dulce, sirens blaring and lights flashing, I try to figure out where we are in relation to the motel where my computer and several extra weapons are stashed. The town is small, so it doesn't take me long to get my bearings, though that also means there aren't many places for me to hide if I do escape from police custody. Once I spot the motel sign in the distance, I memorize the turns we make. They take me to a small station in the center of town. I guess Dulce doesn't need much of a police presence. The deputy pulls me out of the back seat and escorts me through the front doors into a small lobby where a woman with a headset sits behind a cluttered desk. The back wall is mostly frosted glass. The woman updates the men on their wounded officer's condition, which isn't looking good, and then I'm taken through a swinging door. The rest of the station is mostly one big open room lined with wooden desks. My eyes dart around. There's a weapons cabinet in the back corner of the room, but it's padlocked. The blinds are down on the windows, and I silently curse myself for not checking to see if there were bars on them when we were still outside.
You want her in holding with Tony?
The deputy asks, motioning to the back of the station, where I can see a man sleeping inside a small cell.
He'll probably be passed out until morning. Just cuff her in a chair for now,
the sheriff responds.
I want her processed by the book.
My left cuff is taken off and attached to the handle on the front of a short metal filing cabinet that has an empty coffee pot on top. The deputy points to a stool beside it, and I begrudgingly sit, pulling on the cuffs as I do, testing the weight of the cabinet. But it's solid. There's no way I'm dragging it out of here. I take in my surroundings. The deputy flips on the coffee maker before walking over to one of the desks. He drops my confiscated blaster, now sealed in an evidence bag, on top of a stack of papers.
"By the book," he murmurs, taking a seat. "Sure thing."
The deputy types on the computer, the sheriff looking over his shoulder. From their conversation, I understand that they're writing up some sort of report about my arrest. The desktop computers they've got here look ancient, and for a second, I think about how easy it would be to hack into them and steal every bit of information I wanted. But that's the least of my concerns right now. Eventually, the sheriff walks over.
"Name?" he asks.
I stare back at him. Neither of us blinks. I don't know how long this goes on. Minutes? Finally, he speaks again.
"Lady, I can do this all night, but eventually you'll probably get tired or hungry. Me? I'll just have the deputy bring me a cheeseburger. Now, you're not going anywhere anytime soon, so you might as well cooperate so we can make your stay more comfortable."
Our standoff continues. He pours himself a steaming cup of fresh coffee, never taking his eyes off me, even when he sips from it. The only thing that interrupts us is when the woman from the front desk comes through the swinging door.
Sheriff, she says, clearly concerned about something. "There are two men here who insist that..."
Before she can finish, the door swings open again and two men in black suits walk in. The first one's older, with thinning white hair and a wide nose. The second man has dark skin, like me, with a thin mustache running over his top lip.
"Special Agent Purdy, with the Federal Bureau of Investigation," the first man says, holding up some identification I can't see. "I've got questions for your detainee."
"Now hold on just one goddamn minute," the sheriff says, starting toward the man. "How the hell did you even know we'd arrested someone?"
Purdy smiles.
"We're always watching, Sheriff."
Of course they are. If the government is working with the Moogs out here, then they're likely monitoring all sorts of communications. I was probably scanned or filmed the entire time I was out by the fence, even if I didn't see any cameras. So much for being careful. Again, I remind myself that I should be back at Yellowhammer, safely behind a computer screen. The deputy and sheriff have a heated, quiet conversation at the front of the room. Purdy walks over to me. He pulls back his jacket and flashes a heavy-looking pistol at me before crossing his arms over his chest.
"Now, why don't you play ball and start by telling me your name?" he asks.
"Sir?" the other man, special agent, says. Purdy turns and finds his partner holding up the bag with my blaster in it. He nods, and the man pockets it. Then Purdy lets out a whistle and turns his attention back to me. When he leans in close, I can smell stale coffee on his breath, and something else. Something rancid.
"Powerful little weapon you had on you," he says. "Where'd you get it?"
I don't say anything. He doesn't seem to mind.
"Thanks for picking her up, boys," Purdy says, motioning to the sheriff. "But I'm officially taking over this investigation."
He smiles at me.
"You and I are going to have a long conversation back at the base."
"What are you talking about?" the sheriff asks.
"That woman's our suspect, and if you think..."
"You can argue with me all you want, but I believe this woman may have information about acts of terrorism planned against this country,
And if you think that means the government is going to let her stay in the hands of this podunk police force, you're delusional. I can practically hear the glee dripping off Purdy's words as he pulls rank on the others. The sheriff sneers, but he doesn't say anything. Still, his hand is on his hip, close to his gun. The other agent puffs out his chest and walks over to the officers. I silently panic. I can't go back to that base. Not as a prisoner. Not if the Moogs are involved there. They'll figure out I'm Lorik somehow and use me. Destroy me like they did Janus. I know too much. About Ella and Creighton. About the white tablet. They can't get into my head. And I don't know if I'm strong enough to withstand whatever torture it is they use to make Janus spill all his secrets. I have to escape. I've tried not to hurt any of the people on this planet. They're just caught in the crossfire of all this. But I don't think Purdy counts. If he's working at the base, he's working with the Moogs. I don't mind hurting him. In fact, I think I'd take great pleasure in it. He leans close again. Hope you enjoy your last few minutes of fresh air. Because if you don't start cooperating, I'll see to it that you never set foot above ground again. I've got one chance. This is for Zophie, I mutter. And then I attempt a desperate escape. Chapter 5. My boot connects with Purdy's stomach. As he reels back, I slip off the chair, crouch as much as I can, and then leap forward, pulling hard against the cuffs. The square drawer in the filing cabinet jerks out behind me. The cuff digs into my flesh as the drawer catches, but I continue in one fluid motion, pulling at the metal with both my hands. It's my greatest luck in life that the drawer is full of coffee supplies and not actual files. I'm able to pull it out. It swings over my head in a sprawling arc, threatening to tear my hand from my body. There's a loud metallic bang as the edge of the drawer smashes against Purdy's face. Suddenly, blood is everywhere.
My nose!
Purdy gropes blindly at the desk behind him.
She broke my fucking nose!
He half collapses into a rolling chair. The other agent has my blaster, so I lunge for Purdy's gun and then slide over the tile flooring, the now empty drawer trailing behind me. I fire a warning shot into the ceiling as I duck behind one of the desks. It's enough to make the sheriff and his deputy take cover. Purdy pulls a walkie-talkie out of his jacket pocket and yells something into it. Suddenly, there's a scream from the lobby, and I can see a couple of dark shapes on the other side of the frosted glass before they come bursting through the swinging door. Two Mogadorians. Shit. I don't hesitate to fire a few shots over the desk at the Moogs, just enough to keep them at bay. The kickback from the weapon is stronger than I expected, and I don't manage to actually hit any of my targets. Blaster fire fills the air and shreds the monitors, papers, and picture frames on the desk. I hear a yelp behind me. Tony, the guy in the holding cell, is on the floor, hands covering his head.
Tony!
I shout. He seems genuinely startled to hear his name, but he looks up and locks eyes with me. I point to my handcuffs.
The key!
He shakes his head, lips quivering. I don't have time for this. I'm not going to get out of here dragging 2 feet of drawer behind me, and from what I can intuit, Tony's something of a regular in this station. If he doesn't help me out, my options are to lose my hand or to try to shoot off the cuffs. I fire 2 more shots over my shoulder and then turn back to Tony, pointing the gun at him.
The key,
I say firmly, directly. His finger quivers as he points to the desk a few feet away from me.
The second drawer,
he says. There's a pause in the blaster fire. I peek around the desk corner to see that the sheriff and deputy have both gone white staring at the Moogs. In turn, the bloodthirsty bastards look back and forth between the lawmen and Purdy, as if asking what they should be doing.
God damn it!
Purdy shouts. He
He's crouched on one side of the cabinet, a bloody handkerchief up to his nose. The other agent is crouched nearby, covering him.
You weren't supposed to see any of this. How many messes am I going to have to clean up tonight?
I use the confusion and dart to the next desk. Blaster shots pepper the filing cabinet drawer with holes. I open the desk and dig through a bunch of small packets of potato chips and candy bars until I find a little key. Maybe luck is with me. I toss the cuffs to the floor and take a fleeting look at my wrist, which is rubbed raw and deep red. I'm about to slam the desk door shut when I see another key, a car key with a tag on it that says 013. I pocket it, just in case. If I can get to the parking lot, number 13 might be my way out of here. I'm going to have to escape this little town somehow, and if this place is crawling with Moogs, I definitely won't be able to get away on foot. On the other side of the station, the cops have realized that the black-eyed, tattooed Moogs are shooting the blasters that likely kill their fellow officer, and they shout all kinds of questions at the bastards. The police train their guns on them. I use that to my advantage. I fire a bullet that shoots straight through the chest of one of the Moogs. He lets out a groan, and then he's just a pile of dust on the floor. The officers shout in confusion. Purdy orders the other agent to take me down, and I fire a shot in their direction. The mostly full coffee pot on the top of the filing cabinet shatters, spilling glass and scalding liquid onto the other agent's head. He cries out in pain as I throw the drawer that had been attached to me seconds before. It smashes out a window on the side of the office. No bars on the outside.
"Damn it!" Purdy shouts. "Take care of them! I'll get the woman!"
The remaining Moog crosses over to the cops in a few quick bounds and swings a thick fist. The sheriff falls in a heap. I make for the window, shooting behind me in Purdy's direction until the gun clicks. I miss him. Still, I caused him to take cover, which buys me a few extra seconds. I jump through the broken-out window. Glass slices my body, grazing me at several points, but it's nothing serious. At least not compared to what will happen if I get dragged away by Moogs. Outside, the air is cool, and I sprint toward the little parking lot at the back of the station where I see a handful of police cars. I pull the key labeled 013 out of my pocket, ready to make my escape. But there is no car 013.
Damn it!
I'm about to make a desperate run for it when I spot two police motorcycles parked against the side of the building. Big, hulking bikes. One of them has number 13 painted on the side. That's my way out of here. It takes me a few seconds to even figure out where the key goes. Then I just push anything that will move until I finally hit a switch on the right handle that turns the damned thing on. The engine revs when I twist one of the controls. It's not unlike some vehicles I've seen on Lorien, and the whole blasted machine nearly shoots out from between my legs, ramming into the wall beside it.
"Whoa!"
I murmur, trying to get my balance again. A shot sounds behind me, and the clear plastic shield on the front of the bike shatters. Purdy's out of the station now, with a new gun pointed in my direction. I immediately regret leaving my blaster behind. It looks like he's having trouble focusing. A filing cabinet to the nose will do that to you, I guess. Still, I'm not taking any chances. I twist the handle again and drive forward. Too fast at first. The bike wobbles, and it feels like I'm going to fall off. But I keep going, slowly accelerating until I can tell the momentum is holding me in place. I don't even try to figure out how to turn on the headlight as I make my way back to my motel room, remembering the path we took to get to the station in the first place. The few minutes it takes me to cross town feel like hours, and I'm sure at every turn I'm going to be met by a line of Moogs. But the streets are quiet, giving me a chance to wonder just how deeply the Moogs have infiltrated the United States, or all countries for that matter. How much have they brainwashed this planet? Is Earth even salvageable? My thoughts go back to the police officers.
There's no way Purdy will let them live. Not after they've seen the Moogs. I grind my teeth until my jaws ache. If I hadn't come here, they'd still be alive. Or maybe not. They were investigating the base after all. They'd caught wind that something was wrong there. It was probably only a matter of time before the Moogs and the FBI made some kind of move. I just sped things up. Soon Dulcie will probably be nothing more than a ghost town. I must look wild by the time I get to the motel, because when I walk into the office to tell the clerk I lost my key, she jumps, but she hands over a spare. Then it's only a couple of minutes before I've packed my laptop and stashed belongings into a spare bag, and am out on the road again, leaving Dulcie and these Moog bastards behind me. I can't stay. They'll be looking for me now, and there's no place to hide in this tiny desert town. I have to get as far away as I can before the reinforcements that Purdy has surely called in arrive. I jet through the darkness, the night wind whipping against my face, and as I race through the streets, I can't help but laugh at the fact that against all odds, I have somehow managed to escape. My coat flaps behind me in the wind, and without warning, my thoughts go to my brother Zane. I wonder if this is what he felt like when he was flying. It's only after a few miles that the shock starts to wear off, and I realize that Janus's ship, no, it's not his anymore, that my ship is being held by what is likely a veritable army of Mogadorians and government agents. How am I ever supposed to recover it? Chapter 6. It's not difficult to get back to my base once I'm out of Dulcie. I ditch the police bike in the first city I come to, figuring I look a little too out of place on it not to arouse suspicion. I catch a bus, the first one that's heading east. The desert slowly fades into green pastures. In Texas, I get a new ride. I opt for a motorbike of my own this time. I'll pick up another SUV later, but for now, I want to feel the wind on my body, to hear it rushing past the black helmet I buy, drowning out all thoughts of what I'm supposed to do, now that I know the guard can't be reunited at this time, and that my ship is being guarded by forces I'll probably never be able to take on single-handedly. Not in a fight, at least. I can't help but dwell on the fact that the Moog presence on Earth is much, much deeper and more expansive than I ever imagined. Or is it? Maybe Dulcie is an anomaly. It might be the only place where the Moogs and the government are working hand in hand. Those could be the only Moogs on this planet, for all I know. The scant amount of intel I had on Janus and the ship meant that it should have been somewhere in the northeastern part of the country. And yet the Moogs, or the FBI, whoever found it, took it across the country. Why transport it all the way to New Mexico unless that was the only place to hide it? More questions. Each time one is answered, five more come up. There has to be something else I can do. I can't just sit around this planet for the next few years waiting for the last of the guard to develop their legacies, counting on them to reemerge as unstoppable war machines. I'm near the Texas-Arkansas border when I realize my goals haven't changed all that much. Sure, the ship is a setback, but my other concerns, figuring out what the hell the Moogs are doing on this planet, are still relevant. Only now the focus has shifted. Instead of being concerned with what they're doing here, I should be trying to figure out how they're operating. Maybe Dulcie is just the beginning of their campaign on this planet. If so, there may still be time to stop them. If the Mogadorians are only beginning to infiltrate the government, maybe there's still time to save humanity. All I have to do is figure out how deep the corruption runs and then expose it. In a way, it's the same thing I was attempting to do on Lorien. Only now, it's not my people I'm trying to push into action,
but another planet entirely. One that has no idea that there are not only intelligent beings throughout the universe, but that they've already infiltrated Earth. But how do I convince a world full of people who might not be exactly open to the idea that they're not alone in this galaxy? When I get back to Yellowhammer, with its useless gate and rolling hills, I go straight to the back office. I type up a letter explaining to the human race who the Mogadorians are and that the Earth's government may have been infiltrated by these bloodthirsty monsters. I give a first-hand account of what I saw at Dulce. When I'm done, my fingers hover over the keyboard. I can get the word out. I can manipulate code and make it so that this article is on the front page of every popular website on the internet. No one would be able to ignore it. I could link it to all the evidence I've gathered on the Moogs and Lorik on Earth so far so that the human race could help me protect my people. But I hesitate. I think again about what I'm doing. Even if I leave out any mention of the Lorik, uploading this information is a hostile act against the Moogs. Exposing them will surely have consequences. What if in trying to warn Earth about what's going on, I push the Moogs to act themselves, to invade or conquer, or the guard to come out of hiding long before they're ready to do so? What if I inadvertently start an interplanetary war? I stare at my screen for what feels like a long time. Eventually, I save the document I've written, but keep it to myself. I realize that maybe I've been thinking on too large a scale. Before I try to get the entire human race on my side, I can start with just a few. Seek out those who already think that there might be life on Mars or Jupiter or hiding in Orion's belt. I know they're out there. I've read their messages in forums and chat rooms and on message boards. I've inspected their blog posts, trying to figure out if they're insane or if maybe the close encounters they've described were with the Lorik or the Moogs. Malcolm is proof that they exist, that they're passionate and that they can be helpful. Though having seen him and his son together, I don't think I'd want to push him into endangering his family anymore. I can gather a small troop of spies and informants, people I can send to do investigations while I stay out of sight. It'll be tricky weeding out the best candidates, but worthwhile. I'll find those without families, people without ties or attachments, people like me. Slowly but surely, I can introduce them to what I'm really doing, who our real enemy is. They're my starting point, just like Pittacus started with Malcolm. There are believers all across this planet. I just need to reach out to them. In between fortifying the security of the ranch and its surrounding area, I set up a website. It looks normal enough. Like a dozen other conspiracy theory webpages or sites dedicated to proving the existence of aliens. Only this one is built on my code, set to harvest the data of anyone who visits it. With that kind of information, I can win over anyone. And who knows? If the Moogs stumble across it, maybe I'll be able to track them as well. I call it Aliens Anonymous. When it's time to create my own identity on the site, I pause, staring at the cursor blinking on screen. I need not just a username, but a new persona. Someone I can establish as a trustworthy figure so that I can gather allies, a person I can be for a long time. I think of the guard and what I'm trying to do. After a few seconds, I tap out a single word. Guard.